and he bore the sin of the multitude. Shekeper al Ma'aseh Ha'egel. He was the one who sought atonement after the sin of the people of Israel sinned with the golden calf. And he prayed on behalf of those who sinned. Shepikesh Rachbim al Posha Yisrael, Sheyasu Yeshua. That Moshe Rabbeinu prayed on behalf of the sinners of Israel that they should return unto God by doing tshuva. He says, "Ve'ein pegiya eretzulot." The word pegiya has the connotation of prayer. You see, the word pogah in Hebrew can have other meanings too. Pogah can mean, you know, like to hit something or to meet something or something like that. But here it's being used in the sense of prayer. So this is what he says. Now the word pegiya refers to prayer. How do we know? Shenema, because the pasuk says, it happens to be a pasuk in Jeremiah, it says, V'yator al tispaleo v'yator maser, right? You, he says, do not pray on behalf of this people. V'yaltisa ba'adom minu espido, nor should you raise on their behalf song and prayer. V'yaltifka bi, and do not entreat me. So the word, you know, tifka, to entreat, is used in the sense of to pray to me on behalf of the people. So Moshe Rabbeinu, in other words, he did all these things on behalf of the people of Israel, and therefore, you know, this is a special reward that he has, that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam himself was the one who took care of Moshe's burial. So with this, we finish the first chapter in Sota. Oh yes, the end of the first chapter. You can say, yeah. And next week in Mitzvah Hashem, we shall begin the second chapter. And of course, I'll make a very brief review again of some of the contents that we had in the first chapter as an introduction to the second chapter. So, Mitzvah Hashem, we will meet next Wednesday night. By that time, all of us will have had something to eat because Tuesday we'll be starving. But Tuesday night we break the fast, right?
Okay.
I said I would summarize very briefly. First of all, many of you were not here during the time, all the weeks that we spent in going over the first chapter. It's very difficult to summarize al regel achat, as we would say, you know, the time that it takes me to stand on one foot, what we've learned in so many weeks of learning. So I simply want to give a very brief outline of some of the halachas that we had, and maybe touch upon one or two of the main things of the agadas that we had. I've already spoken about the difference between halacha and agadah. Halacha is actually law, okay? This is the procedure, this is what has to be done, and so on. And agadah, remember, refers to anything that has to deal with philosophy, ethics, stories, and in order to fill in what we learn in the Bible and things like that, and so on. This is all in the realm of agadah. Okay. Now, the theme of Sota, if you remember, is based upon a chapter that we read in Bamidbar Parshat Noso, to be exact. It begins with chapter 5. Well, it begins actually with verse 6. It's in chapter 5, but it begins with verse 11. All right, so if you want to look it up in the Chumash, you can do so easily. And if you remember, the basic theme that we're dealing with over here is that a husband is suspicious that his wife is having to do with another man. And so what happens in such a case? He doesn't have 100% proof, but he notices that she seems to be much too friendly with somebody, and witnesses come and say that, you know, you notice that they seem to be secluded or something like that, that it doesn't look right. So what happens at that point? So he has to have, first of all, two witnesses who've testified that they've seen something that doesn't look quite right, okay? And then, of course, he has to come to the Beis Din and, make an official proclamation. And at the same time, he has to tell his wife that, look, I don't want you ever again to be seen secluded with that particular person, okay? So these are various stages. What if then she goes ahead and anyway she enters into seclusion with this person against whom
the husband warned her that she is not to, then in that case has to come back again to the Beis Din, and they judge, and they have to judge on various things. They have to judge on the basis of what the witnesses actually see. Was she there, for example, secluded, for a time sufficient for something unseemly to have taken place, you see. Obviously, if that's not the case, then there's no case, period, and so on. But if they determine that there are grounds for suspicion, then in that particular case, we learned in the course of the first chapter that the Beis Din then decides that, okay, she should go to Yerushalayim, the husband has to go with her, and they appoint two Talmidei Chachomim, two Torah scholars, to go and accompany them to make sure that nothing happens on the way. One of the important things to make sure that nothing happens on the way is that the husband and the wife, do not sleep together, because if they do, then there's no point to the whole deal, obviously. All bets are off, okay? So if the husband really wants to test his wife, then in that case, he's not allowed to have anything, any relations with her during the time that they go. And this is why we have the two Talmidei Chachamim to witness that nothing untoward has happened. But at the same time, also, they have to instruct her again, her and him and so on, and point out, that unfortunately there are circumstances, that bring a bad reputation upon a person and so on. And if indeed, she has committed adultery, then in that case, she's not going to be put to death. This I'll tell you right now. She's not going to be put to death. But what will happen is that the husband will divorce her and she loses the monetary settlement, what we call the ksub. Okay? So they ask her, if she really did so, then be honest and confess, and this is what will happen, and that's all. Then the union will be dissolved and you don't have to live together with him anymore. Okay? But if she insists, that she is innocent, then what happens? Then, as we say, they come to the Beis HaMikdash, and once they get to the Beis HaMikdash, again, they have to appear this time not before the local Sanhedrin, which took place before, but they come now before the Sanhedrin in the Beis HaMikdash itself. There is somewhat of a question as to whether this was the Sanhedrin of 23 that met in the Beis HaMikdash, or was this the Sanhedrin of 71 that met in the Beis HaMikdash. But in any case, they have to again hear what are the facts in the case and everything else, and again, they plead with her that if indeed she did commit adultery, she should confess. And they bring out all kinds of examples taken from the Bible of people who confessed that they were wrong and God forgave their sins. We had the business of, for example, Yehuda and Tamar. Yehuda suspected Tamar of having committed an act for which he felt that she should be punished very, very severely, and yet at the same time, when she produced the evidence that the Yehuda actually was the person who had had relations with her, so he said that Satka Bimeni, in other words, he confessed the fact that she was the one who was right and he was the person who was wrong, and as a result, God not only forgave the sin that Yehuda had committed, but through Tamar's children, eventually there would be, the progeny, that would result in King David, you see. Yes.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
If she were to confess, wasn't that a sin for which she could be stoned? Wasn't that one of the... if it was adultery.
If you're talking about the sota, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Why? Because there have to be two witnesses who catch her exactly in the action, and they have to give a warning that if she does this, she and the paramour, that they should be aware of the fact that there is a death punish, there is a death penalty that could be imposed for it, and so on. So, if you don't have witnesses to this particular action, then that's it. But the idea of the sota is the fact that the husband and wife, obviously, the shidduch is not a very good shidduch, okay? and he's suspicious of her. He doesn't have the complete evidence, that she has, and she certainly is not, liable to the death penalty. But at the same time, if the union cannot exist anymore, because she is prohibited, if she has committed adultery, she is prohibited both to her husband and also to her paramour. So we say, she's asur le ba'ala or le bo'ala, okay? In other words, the both of them. But she can't live with them, in either case. So this being the case, the best thing would be to dissolve the union. Also, she forfeits because of her adultery, she forfeits the ksuba. But at least, she's free afterwards to marry whoever she wants to, whatever it may be, you see. Because, subject to the various rules of what happens in the case of a divorcee, because with a divorcee, you have certain restrictions. A divorcee cannot marry a kohen, for example. Okay? Or, as I said before, she, strictly speaking, cannot marry also, her lover. She can't do that either. Okay? All right. So, anyway, then we learned, that the Kohen Gadol, not the Kohen Gadol, but the Kohen who is there, he has to perform certain acts in order that she should feel, first of all, disgraced if in truth she persists, but nevertheless she is guilty. That's one reason. And the other thing is also we learned that it should serve in general as a warning to men and women that they should not be guilty of this kind of action. So, he performs this part of the service, which consists, for example, of first of all uncovering her hair, because a modest woman always kept her hair covered, right? So he uncovers her hair, he disarrays it, and so on and so forth. Also, he rips the garment a little, he ties a rope around her. All these are meant in order to show the fact, that her conduct is not to be imitated. Okay? Alright, so that was part of the halacha that we learned in the first chapter. But we also had a load of agadata, and the agada dealt with many things. It dealt, for example, with the subject of jealousy. What a sin jealousy is. Lashon hara, what a sin it is. What a sin is haughtiness, pride, and so on. It speaks about these various qualities. And then, of course, what we've had for page after page in the last few weeks, the general concept of midah keneged midah, in other words, that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam rewards or punishes a person in accordance with the actions that they perform. And that may be both for bad, in other words, a wicked person can be punished for the things that did. As for example, they bring the case of Avshalom, who he was so proud of the tremendous head of hair that he had and so on, that he got swelled up with pride, and of course it was the hair then that proved to be his downfall. Or we learned about Samson also, that he, who should have led a more circumspect life, but nevertheless, he was continually chasing the shiksas and things like that and so on. Yeah. And of course, this eventually brought about his downfall too and so on. On the other hand, we saw, in the last few weeks that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam rewarded people. He rewarded Yehuda and Tamar, for example, by making them, the ancestors of Jewish royalty, okay? He rewarded Yosef for taking care of the burial of his father. He rewarded Moshe Rabbeinu for taking care of Yosef's burial, and so on. And then Moshe Rabbeinu, as we learned, in the last couple of weeks, was given the special honor that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam himself was the one who took care of his burial. And then we learned in general what? That one of the great, that we should follow in the midos, we should follow in the qualities of the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, right? Just as the Rabbeinu Shel Olam is Rachum Vachanun, he's merciful and kind, and is Baal Bisharumim, he clothes the naked, he's Mevakeh Cholim, he visits the sick, and we bring examples from the Torah in order to prove all these things. So likewise, we too, and Menachem Avelim, in other words, he also comforts, those who have lost their dear ones. So we should emulate these qualities. So that this is what we had in the first chapter. We are now ready to continue with the second chapter, which we find at the bottom of Yud Dalet, Omid Aleph. And here it is based upon what follows in the text in the Torah. Okay? Torah says, Vehevi ho'ish es ishto el ha-kohen, that the man has to bring his wife to the Kohen, right? So far, I mean, he's already brought it to the Kohen. I mean, that we had in the first chapter. But now what happens? Then it says, Vehevi es korbono oleho, he has to bring her sacrifice, which, you know, is for her benefit, so to speak. And what is it? Asiris ho'efo kemach siorim, it has to be a tenth of an efo of flour, but what kind of flour? Seorim. Seorim is barley. Normally, when a mincha was brought, and I'll speak about that in a second, so the korban mincha had to be of solus. It had to be the finest flour of wheat. And it had to go through a process of being sifted again and again and again and again to make sure that it was solus. It was the finest flour, because the rest of the stuff, you know, could not be used as a sacrifice to God. Now the Korban Mincha is also a sacrifice, just as animals were sacrificed. So Mincha, in other words, a cereal offering, was also Kodesh Kodoshim, was Holy of Holies. And there are different types. In the Sefer Vayikra we have different types mentioned depending upon what is the idea behind it. For example, some of them, usually, for example, you have to bring chametz. You have to bring matzah, okay? In other words, it's not allowed to be chametz. There are a couple where it had to be specifically chametz, but all the others, it had to be always matzah. In the sense, you know, not that, you know, like manashevitz matzah, but in the sense that it contains no chametz, whatever. That, yes. And it had to be mixed with oil, shemen, okay? And then as part of the ritual, it also had to have some grains of frankincense, or lavona is the Hebrew word for that, that was placed upon it, okay? So we're going to touch upon it tonight as we take a look at it. All right. Now, how is this different? So first thing that we said, that this is kemach tziorim, okay? It's made out of barley and not out of chitim. Okay, which would be wheat. Secondly, it's written lo yitzok olav shemen, not allowed to pour oil in it. Okay, but lo yitain olav levona, nor to place any levona, any frankincense upon it. Why? Because this is a special type of mincha. Ki minchas kenoesu, because this is the meal offering which is given because the husband is jealous of his wife, and he feels, you know, that she has done wrong. That's the reason why. And therefore it is a maskeres avon. It is meant in order to to people should remember sin. Okay? And then of course it's written the hikri v'sal kohen, the kohen has to offer it, right? The hemidol te Hashem, and then he places her before the Lord, literally. In other words, he places her, you know, in the temple, right? And then it's written that he has to take mayim kedoshim b'chli choras, he has to take sanctified water in a potsherd, okay? And he has to take dust from it and put it into the water, and this is going to be mixed and eventually given to her. All right, now this will come later on in the chapter when we deal with more of the details. Right now, the chapter begins by discussing the mincha, the meal offering that she had to bring. Okay, so this is what the Mishnah Tal says. Okay, it says Hoyo mevi es binchosar besoch kefifa mitzvis. Okay, he would bring. The question is, who is the he? The answer is the husband, because he has to come with his wife together. Okay, so he would bring her mincha in a kefifa mitzvis. Now, what is kefifa? The answer is kefifa, some kind of a basket. And what is mitzvahs? Now there was, we had it once before mentioned, it was earlier in the chapter that they mentioned it. Mitzvahs here, some say that it's Egyptian, certain type, but in reality it wasn't a, rather, the reference over here is the fact that it's made out of twigs, you know, sort of like a basket, you know, like we have, you know, where you weave one with the other and so on, okay? And according to Rashi, if you take a look over here, all right, maybe it's been chosa, habal, in other words, it's the husband has to bring it, kedetziv, maybe it's korbano aleh, that he has to bring her sacrifice together with her. And then kapipa mitzvah, it says, sal shel nitzrei dekel, right? In other words, it is a basket made out of twigs of the date palm. Zerodim shegedelim sevel hadekel. It says, these are the, like the kind of, the shoots that you find around the date palm. Now, if you go to Eretz Yisrael, or maybe in California too, or some other places, you know, where you have date palms, you can see that when you have a date palm, that there are like little, you know, there are like sharp twigs that go out of it. So they could be cut and then woven into a basket. Okay? So this is the receptacle in which they have to bring the mincha. Then he says, "V'nosal yodeho," and he places this basket, containing, of course, you know, the flour and so on her hands, k'dei liyago, in order to weary her, to make her a little tired, because if she becomes a little tired, she may decide, what's the point in going through with the whole business? I'm guilty. So let me confess, and then that's it, no more. Then the Mishnah says, "Kol hamenochos, every type of a mincha, of course, excluding this one, right? So techilosam esofem mechli shareis." It says, from the moment that you begin to put the flour in and everything else, it has to be in a vessel which is dedicated to the service of the Beis Hamikdash. It has to be in a sanctified vessel, okay? And of course, this is also true that, you know, the final stages of whatever takes place also has to be in a sanctified vessel. Now, why the final stages? So this we'll see as we go on. What is the procedure that takes place, okay? Bezu, however, in this particular case, tchilotzo b'chfifo mitzvis, it begins with what? With a basket, as we described it, right? A basket of twigs, right? With sofa b'chli shoris, but only the final stage of the this particular korban mincha is in a sanctified vessel. Then another distinction says, kol hamenochos tu'no shemen levono. All types of mincha require the use of oil, that is pure olive oil, okay? And levona, the frankincense, which, as I said, is placed on it after it's been mixed, okay? V'zu eno te'uno lo shemen lo levona. But this particular mincha is not, does not require, not just not require, but it does not contain either the oil or the levona, or the frankincense. Kol ha-menochos bo'es ben achitin, right? All other menochos come from wheat. V'zu bo min ha-sorim. This comes from barley, okay? Now, there is one other one, however, that comes from barley, and that is the omer, where it's written, you know, this was brought, they had to cut, go to the field the first night of Pesach. I don't mean the Seder night, but, you know, as soon as the first day is over and it becomes night, right? So they had to go, the Kohanim went to a field, and there they cut barley, and then of course they had to bring it back to the Beis HaMikdash, where they had to beat it and sift it and everything else and so on until it was the finest type of barley flour that you had, all right? And then it was sacrificed, okay?
And this was permissible for Pesach.
Yes.
You're saying it's on Pesach.
Right. Right, the second night of Pesach is when this happened, and then the following day they offered it up as a sacrifice, and that meant that beginning on the second day of Pesach, all the new grain of that would grow during the year would now be permissible. Even today, there are people who make a distinction between what is called Yoshan and Chodosh. Yoshan in Hebrew means old, right? Mm-hmm. And chodosh means new. So that, let's say, if it is sometime prior to Pesach, people will not use new grain. They use up only the old grain. That is, people who observe this. We here don't particularly observe it, but there are people who do, okay? And you'll find in New York and some other places and so on, Eretz Yisrael, you find that the special sign saying we use only yashan, we use only old flour, we don't use any chadash. Because until the beginning of Pesach, you're not allowed to have it. After the first couple of days of Pesach, then you're allowed to use the chadash. Okay, the
is
new
barley flour. We don't use barley flour for Pesach.
We only use white. Why don't we? It's not that it's prohibited.
Oh.
There are five different types of grain from which you can make matzah. Okay, but needless to say, as much as possible, we want it to be of the finest quality. And there's no comparison between
the wheat
and the barley. So that's the basic reason why, okay? But the Mishnah and Psachim, of course, the Gemara and so on, you know, they mention five different types of grain from which it could come, okay? Peter, Kuspin, Shibolashoa, I'm not going into all of them, I mean. For example, wheat, rye, barley, you see these things. I mean, there are people today, in England, for example, there's a special bakery where because people have trouble with gluten, so they make matzah out of rye, and then they import it to this country. Of course, you pay for the privilege, you know, of using it. But nevertheless, it's perfectly kosher, because it does not have to necessarily be wheat flour. As long as it's from one of these five flours, which according to the Mishnah, they can become chametz. And that's the reason why. If something can become chametz, then it means that it's also valid for making matzah. Naturally, you have to watch that flour, right? You have to be very, very careful with the baking and everything else and so on, that it's not going to become chametz steak. But nevertheless, to begin with, it could be any of these five different grains, okay? Alright, so the Minchas HaOmer, as the Mishnah tells us, in other words, the cereal offering, which was to celebrate the beginning of the Omer period, right? So Afal Pi Shebo Min HaSeorit, even though it came from barley, but he HaYisoa BaGeres, it came of the finest type of barley flour, Zubo Kemach. But this particular one is made simply of Kemach, in other words, ordinary barley flour. Okay, take a look at the Rashi for a moment. All right. Okay, Tilosam Saifan. Let's see where the Rashi is over there. It says Shom at the side of it. Okay? So, the Mishnah, remember, said that all the Menachos, which is incidentally the plural of the word Mincha, just as Samochis, strictly speaking, is the plural of the word Simcha. Okay? In Israel, where they speak Hebrew fluently, so you say, you know, Shetiskulis Machot, that you should be able to celebrate all kinds of simchas. But you know, simchas is already the Yiddish plural, okay? Yeah. What is the plural of the word simla?
Simla?
Yeah, dress?
Simla?
Simalot.
Simalot.
Simalot, right, okay. So this is a rule that, you know, words that belong to that particular pattern, that they form their plural accordingly, okay? All right, so it says, in the case of ordinary menachot, right? So, hashto mashma, kishem aviyah mebeisam aviyah b'chlisho is lazora, right? So, she should bring it, if it were like all the other menachos, then she should bring it in a klisho race. In other words, in a vessel, you know, which becomes sanctified. But that's not what it is. But so far, B'chli Shoreis, in the end, is always before, and there's a step to Kamitsa that I'll speak about afterwards. All right. Kol Amnochas Hu Neshem Lebono, all the menachos that we have require the use of oil and frankincense. Kedirsev, as the pasuk says, v'yotzak olev shemen, that he is to pour olive oil on the flour, right? Because he has to mix it too. And then menosan olev levono, and he's also to put frankincense on it. Well, the kame porich, and afterwards they're going to ask the following question. It says, well, this is not too important. There is also another type of mincha. But all right. Then the zunei natuna, however, in this case, the chsiv bo alo yitzok alah hashavim, says you're not to do it. So that therefore this is different. All right. Others, they come in achitin, right? Bos min achitin, the chsiv solas chitim ta'aseh ason, you have to make it a fine flour, right? But this is not. The others are mincha se'omer bo min ha'se'orim. True, it comes from that. But maseches menochos, yalfin lo mikrayv, and we learn it in maseches menochos from psukim in the Torah. But this, that comes bo ageres, nechsev geres karmel, takriv es mitchas bikurecha. That you are to have the finest barley flour in this particular case when you offer up the mincha. This is a bikurim, this is a first mincha offering, because remember, when is it brought? It's brought at the beginning of Pesach, right? To mark the beginning of the season when all grain becomes permissible. Okay. There it says, you know, that we're talking about the Omer offering. Geras, he says, Bisa Orim, Muv Koshebo. He says, the geris means that in barley, this is the finest quality that we have. Minupe, the yud gimel nopa. It has to be strained in 13 different strainers in order to make sure that you have only the purest and the finest that survive to be used. Okay? Ke'en solas chitim, just as is the practice in to get the finest wheat flour, okay? But in this case, it's kemach. Now, normally you translate kemach simply as flour, right? Usually, of course, we think in terms of wheat flour, but remember, it could be any kind of flour. And he says, what is kemach? He says, hakol me'urav. Everything is just mixed in, kemosha nitchan, just as it was ground. In other words, you don't sift it, but the way, you grind the barley. So this is what they used in order to make this particular mincha. Okay. Now to complete the rest of the Mishnah and then to begin the Gemara. Rabbi Gamliel Omer, it says, Kishem Shemaaseh Maaseh Behemo, Kach Korbanu Machal Behemo. It says, why does the Torah decide that her mincha should be barley rather than wheat? Okay. So he says, because barley was used in the time of the Talmud as food, as fodder for animals. You know, they would make cakes of it. So he says, just as she behaved like a behemoth, so likewise she should also then eat a machal behemoth. In other words, a machal, you know, that you feed to a behemoth. Okay?
Yeah, I think it's. And I have an objection to this whole thing, and I'm sitting here kind of...
Okay, let's hear your objection.
Well, my objection to all of this is the presumed guilt involved here.
Ah, okay.
And, I mean, she could be terribly upset by all of these things that are going on.
Right.
It's like a lie detector. You
could
throw it off
just
by being upset by getting a lie detector. You could be telling the truth, but the results would indicate you were lying.
Right, okay. What you say is quite pertinent. There's no question about it. But let's review again the facts. Why was he suspicious of her in the first place?
It is.
Well, it says that somebody came and said they saw her secreting herself somewhere.
One somebody wouldn't be enough. You have to have at least two witnesses who saw it happen.
Yeah.
Okay? So that gives him grounds of suspicion. Okay? But at this particular point, the whole thing comes to an end if he doesn't do what? If he doesn't give a warning that she's not to seclude herself
and
with
she has done
this
it
one, right?
And someone, then she defied him. Two more people
right.
have seen her.
Yes.
Two more people have
right.
seen her.
Right. They've
secluding.
Seen that she secluded herself. Right. In spite of the husband's warning. And, you know, and then, you know, the indication is also that the amount of time that was spent was such that they could have had, unseemly conduct, okay?
And this could not, and the witnesses are not under the aegis of Lashon Hara. I mean,
if they were guilty of Lashon Hara, we wouldn't be discussing this.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, it's possible.
I mean, you know,
I don't say.
I'm playing
look,
devil's
look,
advocate.
I understand.
Here.
Okay.
I'm the lawyer
right.
for the defense.
Let's say
here.
That, Taka, they were guilty
yeah.
of Lashon Hara, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, in other words, that there was no basis
there
for what they had to say.
There was gossip going
right?
on. And
so, therefore,
they saw
this is the reason why she insists that she is innocent, okay?
Yeah.
But the whole purpose, again, is not only to establish the fact that she is innocent. You understand?
Yeah.
If she persists. But also, if she is guilty, let her confess that she's guilty and terminate the marriage this way, okay?
Okay, well.
I mean, so
I,
let her do
I,
it.
I
let her confess.
What's going on
because
here,
confession is good for the soul, so to speak,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
The Rabbeinu Shalom is ready to forgive you if you confess your sins. But there's also a third angle that's involved, and that's the one that I mentioned also. Namely, that this procedure is also not just for her, but that other people shouldn't get the idea of infidelity.
Mm-hmm.
It's to stress the importance of fidelity. I mean, a husband and wife should be faithful to each other.
Yeah.
You missed also where we had that the feeling is that if the husband himself has been unfaithful, then in that particular case, there's no point to this whole deal, to the ordeal.
Yeah.
Because he has to be just as guiltless as she claims that she's guiltless. Understand? Because otherwise, I mean, if he's a bum, then there's no point in going through with it because his moral character is no good. Okay? This also we had a long time ago. See, part of the problem is that you weren't, here, week after week. You know, we're
right,
developing this thesis.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Okay, so that's the reason why. Okay. All right. Tanya. We have learned. Okay. Abba Chanan Omer Misham Rabbi Eliezer. Abba Chanan says the name Rabbi Eliezer, right? V'chol kach lama. Why does she have to, you know, go through all this? It's kedei liyago, right? It's that she should become weary. Kedei shetachsobor. So that she can do tshuva and admit that she was wrong and so on. If she really did that, then let her do it. And that's all there is to it. It's to encourage her, you see, to admit her guilt if she is guilty. If she's not guilty, then she has every right, you know, to insist to go ahead that she wants to have the ordeal because she wants to prove the fact that she was not guilty. Okay? So he says, Im kocho, if this is the case, then you say that kosa Torah al over ritzono, right? That just as the Torah wants to has, in other words, has feelings of honor and regret and respect, that respect is the word I'm looking for, has respects people who sin, but the Rabbeinu Shalom wants to give them every chance, you know, to turn aside from their sin, to confess their sin, to turn aside from them, to do good. So all the more does the Torah respect a person, you know, who does that which is right. In other words, even a sinner is given a chance by the Torah. Because the basic idea, again, is not so much, you know, that we want to punish the sinner, but we want the sinner to turn from his or her evil way and, you know, do tshuva and do that which is right, live a life of righteousness. This is what the Torah wants us to do, okay? So anyway, somebody comes and he says, well, maybe there's another reason why. He says, Dilmo, he says, Ki heche de lo simachek negila. Maybe the basic reason why they're doing it is simply not because so much that they're interested in the tshuva aspect, but maybe it is because they don't want the next step, which would be to write out on a scroll the blessings, the curses, you know, whatever we find over here, the psukim, the verses that we have over here in the Torah. And remember what happens then. The water has to be used first in order to erase the words that are over there. The Kohen has to erase it with the water, the Mayim HaBa'arim, right? And at the same time, it also contains the name of God. And we are enjoined, of course, not to erase the name of God. And still, here, the name of God is erased in the attempt in order to try to bring peace between husband and wife. So, if she is guilty, then maybe the idea is, you know, that she should do, you know, she should admit her guilt so that the name of God would not be erased. That would be another black box, so to speak, you know, against her character, you'd see, if it would happen, okay? So he says maybe that's the reason why, you know, they tried to tire her out and so on. So he says, no. The Gila, he says, Kosovar, he says, he thinks that Amashka, that the procedure is that first he gives her to drink, V'yachakach, Makrivis bin Chosa. And afterwards, then the Kohen goes and is going to sacrifice her mincha. We'll talk about that a little bit later as we go in the order. But he says, the Ibishum Megillo Himchachalei. He says, no, the basic reason is that, look, if we're talking about that you're afraid to raise the Megillah, but when is the mincha, when does she have to actually present the mincha? This is after she's already drunk the Mayim HaMa'orim. So that could not be the reason why. The reason why, you know, is that we said, basically because we want her to do tshuva and to confess her sin, if indeed, you know, she is guilty. Okay? Alright, it's getting a little late. I'll tell you what, we'll do another few minutes and, yeah. Okay, yeah. Yes.
At what point does she have to start carrying
Okay, she has to start carrying it when she gets into the Beis HaMikdash. Right, she has to schlep it over there, and you know, together with the husband, they go to the Kohen. Okay, and she has to carry it. And apparently, they figure that, you know, the basket itself is heavy, because I don't imagine that you know, the flour itself should be quite so heavy. Mm-hmm. But you know, I have to assume that it's a heavy basket. Okay. Yeah. All right. Now, we'll do a little bit more in over here. Raminu, he says, we have a kasha. Kasha is based upon the fact that there is a tosefta. Tosefta means that this is a separate collection of literature at the time of the Mishnah, but it was not included in the regular Mishnah. But nevertheless, it has, you know, great Talmudic authorities behind it and so on. And the Gemara very often will quote a Tosefta in order to explain or to bolster a contention or to try to settle, let's say, two differences of opinion that we have in the Mishnah, and you know, try to arrive at you know, what the probable answer would be and so on. All right, says Kol Abnochos Aminu. He asked the following question: says Seder Menochos Ketzan. What is the order in which a person brings menachos? Okay? So he says, Odom evi mincha. And here we're talking about in general. What is, you know, what is the procedure when you bring a korban mincha? It says, Odom evi mincha, mitoch beiso. Person brings his mincha from his house, mikloso shel kesef v'shel zohav. In vessels, literally baskets, okay? In baskets of silver or gold. In other words, the ordinary person who wants to give a korban mincha, naturally he wants to give the very best that he has. And so therefore, when he would bring it in the basket of gold or silver. Now, I don't know whether it means that the entire basket was made of gold and silver, or does it mean that it was a basket which was decorated with gold and silver. Because the reason I ask that, we have a description in the Mishnah Bikurim of how they would bring the first fruits of the Beis HaMikdash. And there it says definitely, you know, that they used to adorn the baskets with silver and with gold and so in order to, you know, to beautify it. So, okay? So maybe that's what it means over here. But in any rate, gold and silver. I mean, this part we can understand. I mean, they wanted to make it as beautiful a ceremony as they possibly could. Okay? The nostro and the so klishores, right? And then he puts it into one of the vessels that was used to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. Umekacho bichli, right? Bichlishores. And he also sanctifies it in this klishores. And then he says, "V'nosin alehu shamno." Then he has to add to it the oil, ulevonoso, and also the frankincense. Umolicha etzel kohen. He brings it to a kohen. After all, the Beis HaMikdash, they had many kohanim over there because, you know, the people would come in, so you had a kohen to serve you. The kohen molicha etzel mizbeach. Then the kohen would bring it to the mizbeach. Umagisho, and he would bring it close, the Karen Dromis Ma'arovis, at the southwest corner of the Mizbeach, Kineget Chudo Shel Karen, opposite the sharp point of the Mizbeach. Okay. The Mizbeach itself, we have over here a diagram. I don't know if you can see it. But, okay, you have to bear in mind, first of all, the geography a little bit over here. All right. When you came in to the Beis HaMikdash from over here, okay? This was the eastern gate. You came in from the east, okay? Obviously, then, where was the Holy of Holies? It was in the west over here, okay? Masdoshim, for example, you had the Ezra's, Yisroel, these were all different courtyards, and each one had more and more Kedusha as you went in, but they were also used, you know, for various purposes. And finally, over here, in this area, primarily it was only the Kohanim, or the Levium. The Kohanim, you know, who performed, you know, the sacrifices of the Levium, because at certain points in the service, they had to sing psalms, okay? Sing psalms, play psalms, and so on and so forth. Okay. So you come in through over here. Now, notice that here is the Mizbeach, okay? But the Mizbeach at this particular point, since this is the east, it's facing the north, okay? Because the Pasuk says, Tzofono lifnei Hashem, towards the north before the God, right? And here you had what is called the Kevesh. Kevesh means the ramp. In other words, the Mizbeach was high. And so they had to go up a ramp in order to get to it. Okay? So the Kohen got up to it. Okay? So now, this would be the south. This is the east. All right, yeah. All right. This is east, right? This is south over here. Okay? So, this is the southeast corner. This is the northwest corner, right? No, excuse me, this is the southwest corner. Southwest corner.
Yeah.
And this would be the northeast corner, and this is the northwest corner. Correct. Okay. All right. So, when the Kohen would bring it up to the altar, because he had to take part of the mincha and, you know, burn it on the altar, okay? So when he came, where did he go? He says, Molicha Eitzel Mizbeach, right? Magisha became Dromis Ma'arovis. All right, in other words, in the southwest corner over here. Okay? This is the southwest corner. He would bring it over here. Now, around the Mizbeach, at each corner, there was what, the Hebrew word for corner in this particular case is Keren. Okay, which has all kinds of meanings, but in this case it means corner, Keren, all right? And the Keren had like a knob on it, and the knob had a point, a chud. That's what he means by the chud. In other words, it rose to a point on each of the four corners, okay? All right, so he places it, you know, about at the same level and facing the point of that part of the altar, okay? Right. Vidayo. Dayo means, you know, the word Dayenu, right?
Yeah.
Dayo means that's enough. In other words, at this point, that's as much as he had to do. What? To bring the basket which contained. That is to bring the klishoris. In other words, the vessel which had the ingredients for the mincha, brings it near to the mizbeach, to the area, you know, where the point, the southwestern corner. Okay. So that's what he means by dayo. That's it. And then he says, a mesalek is halavono, the tzadekot. Then he has to take the frankincense and push it aside to one side. The komates, mimokam shnis rabbi shabda. Now, komates is as follows. The kohen has to take a handful of the flour, okay? But it has to be an exact amount, okay? And according to another Mishnah, not over here, but, you know, in the Mishnah in general, Menachos over there, it's written that the komates is, he has to use the three middle fingers in order to put it into his hand, and as much flour as he can take over here. This was the komates, the handful that he had, okay? And so he takes it, right? And he takes that, where he takes from the place where there is a lot of oil over there.
A lot of what?
A lot of oil. Because the oil, you know, we put in oil, but in some, right,
the flour,
right.
And
there was an area where there was more oil than others, you know, okay? But most of the sockly shows, he puts it into a special vessel, right? Umekacho bichlishoris, and he sanctifies it in this klishoris. And then umalakit is lebonaso, and then he gathers again the frankincense, the nosnal gabot, and he puts it on the top of, the komets that he has already taken. Okay, umalehu, and he offers it up, umaktiro, and he causes it to burn on the, you know, the fire on the altar, bichlishoris. But the question is, at first blush, it would seem that he does it in the vessel itself, but he doesn't. Actually, it means that he takes it and he pours the contents from the klishoris onto the mizbeach. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Umolcho. But he's not finished yet, because besides all that, he has to do something else. He has to put salt on it. Because it's written in the Torah, Al kol korboncho tovi melach. Whatever sacrifice you bring, you have to bring salt. Whatever the reason was, but this is what the Torah says. So he has to put salt on this too. Okay? V'nosu agave hi'ishim, and he puts it on the fire over there, the flames. Okay? Yeah. Then the Mishnah, the set continues and says, korav ha'komets. Once this komets, in other words, this handful of flour, you know, mixed with the lavona and the oil and so on, is burnt on the altar, then in that case, shioreho ne'echolin, right? Then whatever is left over of the flour that had been brought originally, this may be eaten, ureshoyan lekohanim, and the priests, who are the ones who have to eat it, they are permitted, l'tein l'socho yayin v'shem u'nedvash, they are permitted to add, if they want, wine, oil, honey to it. Okay? The yain asurin, and the only thing that they are prohibited from doing is el milech chametz. They're not allowed to let it turn into chametz. Okay. All right, I'm going to stop at this point because we have to digest this. And then next week, in the session, we shall continue with the description. This is, you see, we're in heavy halacha, you know. The base of Mikveh should be rebuilt. We have to refresh our memories. We're on Yud Dalet Amud Beis. David will profit by this.
All right.
Okay.
We're recording also, not only for ourselves, but also with David Hirsch on mind.
That's right.
We're going to send these tapes to Israel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll make a copy and send it to Israel.
I want to again refresh our memory as far as certain of the technical terms that we're using here tonight, okay? First of all, what do we mean by the word mincha? So here it doesn't refer to the afternoon service, but it means instead literally a gift, because that's the original meaning of the word mincha. It was a gift. Mm-hmm. But specifically, what the mincha is over here is the offering given consisting of flour mixed with oil, and upon which frankincense was poured. Okay? And then, after that, various things would happen. Okay? But basically, one of the important things is what we call the komets. What is the komets? Komets means that the priest takes the three middle fingers of his hand, and he takes as much flour as it could hold. He's not allowed to spill any of it, but he has to take it and put it into what we call a kli shoreis. In other words, one of the vessels that they use in order to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. Naturally, it has been sanctified for service over there, but at the same time, by putting it into it, so therefore it sort of becomes sanctified itself. In other words, the kli itself sanctifies the contents. This is one of the things, Mitzvah Shem, that tonight we may touch upon a little bit later in the discussion. Alright? This komets has to be burnt on the altar, because this corresponds to the sacrifice that would, let's say, an animal sacrifice, where one of the important things, I mean, what happens when an animal is sacrificed? Okay, various things happen, but naturally the first job is what we call shechita. In other words, actually there's even a prior thing prior to that. Prior to that we have what we call smicha. Smicha in this case means literally putting the hands on. The person who offers, who brings the offering, he has to put his hands on the animal's head, right? Mm-hmm. In order to indicate what? That he is offering it as a sacrifice on behalf of himself, the family, etc., whatever it may be. Okay, so this is smicha. And then the animal has to be slaughtered, right? You have to perform shechita on it. It could be a zor, it could be a layman, but very often it was a kohen who did the job, because the kohanim, you know, they were experts over there, they knew what to do.
The shechita, you mean?
The shechita, right. And then, at this particular point, the layman is finished with his job. From this point, it's only kohanim who are permitted to serve. What did they have to do? They had to gather the blood in a basin, okay? And of course the basin also is a kli shoreis, right? And then they would bring it over to the altar, and the blood had to be splashed upon the altar in accordance with various types. I mean, for different things, it might be that you had to do it on all four corners of the altar, it might be on two opposite corners, or it might be the only one corner, but when you do it, you know, you make sure that it sort of goes in both directions, okay? But this would depend on the type of the sacrifice that is being brought over there, okay? And then, normally, parts of the animal would be burnt on the altar, but that would depend, again, on the nature of the sacrifice. Obviously, a burnt offering had to be completely consumed, but first it had to be cut up into pieces. And the skin had to be removed, first of all. And then cut up into pieces, and then the various organs and limbs and so on were burnt on the altar.
They take the inner cell?
Yeah. It was put on top, right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course, the animal also had to be cleansed. There was a special room in the Beis HaMikdash where they prepared all these things, including cleansing of the inner part of the animal. Okay.
Who did all the cleaning up?
Who did? They had a very ingenious system whereby they were able to run streams of water in the Beis HaMikdash floor, and they were able to clean the Beis HaMikdash every day. It had to be kept clean, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So they would do that, right?
Otherwise,
I would
have
to tell you. Pardon me?
Who cleaned the altar itself?
The altar itself did not necessarily require cleaning, but what it did require, it required atonement. That was the job of Yom Kippur.
What did they use for splashing of the blood?
For the slicing of the blood?
Yeah, the blood, when they give the blood.
No, they had to pour it from the basin. Yes.
But that's bloody.
It spritz, right. Yeah. And then after that, whatever was left had to be poured. There was like a channel at the bottom of the mizbeach,
right,
upon which you poured the rest of it, okay?
You sprinkle with their fingers?
No, with the basin.
Sometimes this was the ritual that was called for. The high priest had to do that on Yom Kippur. This was part of his job. There are also a couple of other types where it had to be done that way, okay? But otherwise, as I said, it would be dashed against the Mizbeach. They would pour some of it again, you know, here, there, whatever it may be. As I said, it all depended on which type of a sacrifice. Other sacrifices, for example, those sacrifices which we call, let's say, shlamim, peace offerings, or todah, Thanksgiving offerings, they were eaten primarily by the people who brought them, okay? But, at the same time, there were certain parts that had to be removed and burnt on the altar, because, after all, the sacrifice involved this, okay? Now, the mincha, coming back to it, the komets, in other words, this handful of flour that the Kohen took, then mixed, you know, with oil and put frankincense on top of it, that was burnt on the altar. So that corresponded, let's say, to the animal sacrifice, okay? Naturally, when did they bring a mincha? So there are various reasons why a mincha was brought instead, okay? As for example, let's say the person was too poor, you know, to bring an animal sacrifice, but he wanted to give a voluntary sacrifice, so he'd bring a mincha, okay.
It have to be in the afternoon, though.
No. But on the other hand, with every sacrifice, there was also a mincha brought, and of course, that would be brought by the Kohen, and that was part of the ritual, you see. And again, there would still be the kolmetz, and et cetera, et cetera, you see. So it all depended, and of course, that would be both in the morning and also in the afternoon, because there were two daily sacrifices. One is in the morning, right? Sakev v'sachot taseh b'boker, so we say, right? And then the sakev v'sashedi, and the second lamb is taseh bein ha'abayim. It has to be literally towards evening, okay? Bein ha'abayim. So usually it was done about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That was the usual time for it, okay? But it had to be in the afternoon sometime, and then together with that, as I said, so a mincha would be brought. But since, again, a mincha could be brought for various reasons, so therefore, the Tosefta, the one that we read last week towards the end of the session, this, that I'm going to review right now, this tells us about the usual procedure for bringing a mincha in the Beis HaMikdash. What happened, okay? However, remember, why is this quoted over here? It's quoted in order to point out the difference between what usually happens when you bring a mincha as compared to what happens if it is the sota, right? The woman who is suspected of adultery by her husband, she has to bring one, and that's in a different category, as we learned. We learned that, for example, whereas the ordinary mincha is made of chitin, in other words, it comes from wheat, and it has to be solus, it has to be fine flour, right? But what did we learn about this minchas kenoas, literally, the mincha brought because the husband is jealous and he suspects that something is, you know, that the wife has been unfaithful, so that has to be of what? It's barley, we learned, right?
Oh, yeah.
And not only barley, but it's not the finest flour of the barley, but it's only ordinary barley flour. So that the idea being, you know, that this is in a different category altogether, because it's not being brought, shall we say, for joyous purposes or whatever it may be, but it's being brought instead because, you know, a very unpleasant situation, right? So that, as we learned, you know, that they considered barley as machal behemah, in other words, food that was fit for an animal, and she behaved in an animal fashion by giving in to her lust, you know, instead of thinking about the fact that you should preserve the faithfulness in marriage. No, we haven't proved this yet.
Is there an approach here for the humane, obviously the deep instructions that humanely to kill the animal?
Yeah.
But also, now I see there's a tie-in because of how they needed the blood.
Yeah.
I don't know if that had part of the involvement and how they killed the animal.
Yeah, well, there are specific rules, of course, for how the slaughtering has to be effected, right? In other words, for an animal, you have to cut the major part of the jugular vein, and also the major part of the esophagus. You have to cut both of them, okay? for a chicken, it's enough to simply make one slit and so on, because it's not as big or anything
they
else.
Wanted but they wanted to be a glutton too.
That would be the best
yes.
way to do it.
Right.
Humanity and also.
So that, the death was very instantaneous. But at the same time, since the Torah says that blood has to be drained, but not allowed to eat blood, and then because in the Beis HaMikdash, the blood of the sacrifice actually was that part, which was dashed on the altar, was connected to the altar, you understand? So that, and this is what is called kapora. I don't mean shlogan kaporas, but I mean kapora means that it's what atones for the sin of the person who brings the sacrifice. So, yes.
As an aside, you mentioned about when a student becomes a rabbi, and is that where the term comes from, the language?
Smicha, right, exactly, because we find in the Torah that, what did Moshe Rabbeinu do to Joshua? Right, he put his hands upon his head, and he, then gave him his blessing and instructed him in what he had to do and so on. So this was the first one. No. Today, smicha is, we use the term, but in reality, nobody puts their hands on. Okay.
They get a diploma.
So they get a diploma, exactly. Right. Yeah. So, but the term remains. After all. Gemara and Sanhedrin, speaks about that to a somewhat greater extent, does actually require laying on of hands, and said no, it doesn't require. But then there are also, the question is, for what purpose, okay? So we have the story about when the rabbis, he saw Tzmicha, so the question is, what is he ordained to do? So the Gemara says, Yoreh, is he permitted to teach? What does it mean by teach? In other words, to instruct people as to whether something is permitted or forbidden, right? That's what they say, Yisra v'heter in Hebrew, right? So he answered, Yoreh. Yes, he's permitted to do it. Yodin, is he permitted to serve as a judge? To judge all kinds of cases? So he said, Yodin, okay? And then the third thing you want to know is Yatir v'choyres, is he permitted also to declare that firstborn animal is released from Kedusha. Speak about that in a second. And in one case it says Yate Bechayres, and another one, when the great Rabbanim, he didn't get it. So the Gemara in the Sanhedrin wants to know why it happened like this. Well, first of all, what do I mean by Yate Bechayres? Okay. According to the law of the Torah, it's written over there, Shor or Kesev or Ways, an ox or a lamb, right, or a goat, tiyavoleid, right, and so on, and so on, and so on. And then it's written kol abchor, and another passage called b'chor asher yavoleid b'chorcha hazochor. In other words, if the very first one born is a zochor, is a male, then taktish lo Hashem Elokecha, you have to sanctify it to become holy to the Lord your God. Okay, you're not allowed to either use it for any kind of work, and in case it's a sheep, you're not allowed to shear it either. Okay. Instead, what does it have to do? It has to be eaten in the Beis HaMikdash. Okay? So, in ancient days, where there was a Beis HaMikdash, so you would bring the Bechor to the Kohen, and, that would be a sacrificial meal for him. Okay? This is one of what we would call the Matnos Kehuna, one of the gifts that a Kohen receives from people, okay? But what happened if there is a mum in it, if there is a blemish? Then in that particular case, the animal cannot be offered up as a sacrifice, okay? So what happens in that case? So the answer is that, it's eaten just like any ordinary food, but it has to be eaten. It's not allowed to be used, nevertheless, in any other way, you see, except for that. Hi, who are you? Pardon me?
Once you don't put the alarm on tonight when you leave,
then
I'll be here.
Oh, okay.
Okay,
fine.
Okay.
Yeah. So, what happens is we would say, but Zman Hazeh, in other words, today when there is no Beis HaMikdash, obviously, no Kohen to whom you can give it, because the Kohanim are also in the state of, you know, they're not in the state of ritual purity, you understand? So that, that they cannot officiate, you know, in the Beis HaMikdash. So that therefore, the law is that the animal has to be permitted just to eat, and there's nothing you can do. You're not allowed, as I said before, either to use it to work with, right? Mm-hmm. Nor are you permitted, in case it's a sheep, you're not allowed to, you know, to shear it either. Okay, right. So that being the case, what do you do? So if it develops a mum, it has to be examined by somebody who recognizes the difference between what we call a mum kavua, which means a blemish which remains permanent from this point on, and a mum over, which means obviously a temporary blemish. So in ancient days they had people who were taka experts in doing this, and if they said that this is a mum kavua, that this is a permanent blemish, then in that case the owner was permitted to eat it. It's permitted to shecht it and to eat it, okay? So therefore they would bring it before the expert. The expert was obviously, he was an expert knowing the difference between what was a temporary blemish as compared to a permanent blemish, and he had the authority to declare either that it was kavua or over, okay? But why in the case of the second one, according to the Gemara, the man was a great Talmud Chacham, and at the same time he didn't get permission to do it? So the answer is because he knew the fine points, and other people seeing, they might misinterpret the reason, you know, why he declared that, for example, the animal is permitted to be eaten. So that therefore he was not given permission in order that people shouldn't get the wrong impression. You know, sometimes you see that somebody is doing something and immediately you jump to a conclusion that, well, if he can do it, I can do it, right? But there may be extenuating circumstances that we're not aware of, which means that maybe this is only a one-time affair, but it's not a permanent thing. So that
owners would be tempted to make permanent blemishes.
They have to keep him.
That you're not allowed to do. Right, that you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to purposely go and make a blemish in the end. Right. Just like you're not allowed to make food which is kosher, you're not allowed to make a treif. If it happens, it happens, but you're not supposed to go, as we would say, lechatchila, and make a treif. Okay. So getting back over here, alright, starting with line 3. So the Tosefta then spoke about Seder Menochos Kesad. What is the procedure for bringing a mincha, right? And menochos being in the plural, so, you know, it means a korban mincha in general. So, odam mevi mincha betach beso. Okay, a person brings the mincha, in other words, he brings the flour and the oil and so on from his home, and what does he bring it in? Biklosov shel kesef. He brings it in baskets of either silver, mishel zahav, or of gold. Benos no lesoch kli shores, and then when it gets to the Beis HaMikdash, so he transfers it from the basket to which he brought it, and he puts it into a sanctified vessel over there. Umekatsho bichli shores, and he sanctifies the mincha, in other words, the what he has brought, the ingredients for this carbon, by putting it in the kli shores. Okay, venosin aleho shamno, and then he mixes in the oil, ulavainoso, and he puts the you know, the frankincense on top of it. Umolicha etzel kohen. And then he brings it to whom? Brings it to the kohen in the Beis HaMikdash. Okay? The kohen molicha etzel mizbeach. The kohen brings it, naturally, in the kli shoris in which it is now, right? He brings it to the mizbeach. Umagisha, and he brings it near Bekeren Dromis Ma'arovis, near the south western corner. Keneged chudo shel keren. Opposite the high point of the horn. Now, I mentioned last week, remember I showed you a diagram of what the Beis HaMikdash looked like, and we saw that the main entrance into the Beis HaMikdash was actually from the east. Okay? They came into the Beis HaMikdash from the east. This is the primary entrance. And then we were in there. So naturally, at the western end, this is where the Holy of Holies was located. Okay? But what was in the courtyard in between?
course, there were various courtyards, but I'm talking now about the main courtyard. Okay, what was there? So the answer is there was the Mizbeach. Mizbeach was, you know, a pretty big structure. It wasn't just like a table set up, I mean, but it was actually, you had to go up on a ramp in order to it, and, you know, it was quite high and so on, right. And where did the ramp originate? The answer is it originated in the southern side, so that you went up, and the first part of the Mizbeach that you would come to actually would be the southern side of the Mizbeach. So naturally, what did the Kohen have to do? And normally, you know, he had to make the rounds, right? Go around it and so on, particularly if it was the kind of a sacrifice, as I said before, let's say an animal sacrifice, where he had to sprinkle blood in all four corners, okay? So after going up the ramp, so he would go around, you know, first this corner, that one, so on and so forth, okay? All right. So this case, he's not putting it on the fire as yet, but all he's doing is to bring it next to a corner of the altar. But which one? The very first one that he comes to, namely the southwestern corner. Okay? Since he's coming up from the south, right, and turning towards the west where the Holy of Holies is, so that would be the southwest corner. Okay? And as I said, each of the at each corner of the Mizbeach there was a height, you know, and this is what they call the keren, in other words, the horn. In other words, over here there was built up, here it was built up, here it was built up, here it was built up, and then in the middle they had what they called the tapuach. Literally apple, but the tapuach also means swollen, because there was like a mound over here made of, you know, the ashes being piled up or something like that, okay? So that was the tapuach over there. All right. The dayo. What is dayo? It's like we say dayenu, right? Dayenu means it's enough for us, so dayo means enough for him. That's what they had to do. Now, after he'd done that, misalek es halabona letzad echad, then he has to take the levona, the frankincense, and put it to one side. The komet, right? And then he takes, as I said, this handful, memokom shenis rabo shamno, from place where the flour has a great deal of oil, where the oil is sort of piled up over there. And what does he do? Then Menosel Mesoch Kli Shoris, then he puts it into another Kli Shoris, okay? Umekacho Bekli Shoris, and he sanctifies it in Kli Shoris. Umelaket is Levonoso, and he gathers up again the Levona that he pushed aside before, right? Menosel Gabov, and he puts it on top now of what he has, right? And then the Ma'alehu, I'm skipping the parenthesis, Ma'alehu, and then he brings it up, Umaktiro, and he puts it on the fire, really is what it means over here, right? Bechli Shores, with the this Kli Shores that he has it in, Umolcho, and he has to, however, put salt in it, because every sacrifice had to have salt, the Torah says. Says even as far as any kind, right, that you have to use melach. So that you have to put salt on every sacrifice that was brought over there. Some say that the salt was used as a preservative, so that, you know, it shouldn't putrefy or anything like that. This is what Hertz quotes in the Chumash, you know. But whatever it is, nevertheless, this is what happened to every sacrifice. And then the Nosal Gabe usually puts it on the fire itself. Korat HaKomets, when now this handful had finally been sacrificed, that is brought, you know, on the altar, then Shiorehu Ne'echolin, as we said, whatever else is left over now from the mincha may be eaten, but naturally by who may be eaten? It has to be eaten only by Kohanim, okay, because it's a sacrifice also. So it's eaten by the Kohanim. The Rashayin HaKohanim L'tem L'Sachoy Yayin L'Shem L'Vash, and the Kohanim are permitted to add to it wine, oil, honey, V'Yein Asun El Mechametz, and they are only prohibited from making the Korban Mincha become chametz. So now this is where the Gemara asks the following question. It says, Katani Miha. Now look, we learned over here, what does it say? It says, Beklasa Shel Kesef, Beklasa Shel Zahav, right? Mm-hmm. That they are brought in baskets of silver and baskets of gold. So, we see that. So, Rab Papa. So, Rab Papa said, Amor, it shows us, or I understand it to mean that what it means is, Bechelim Haruin Lechli Shores. That has to be brought, that in other words, the mincha has to be brought, the ingredients, in vessels which are worthy enough in order to be kli shoreis. In other words, it has to be something important. That's why, what was the mincha that she brought, the sota? The answer is it was in an ordinary wicker basket, if you remember, you know, made of twigs and so on and so forth. Yeah. And here we see that a mincha should be brought either with golden basket, silver basket. I said it doesn't necessarily mean that the entire basket is made of gold and silver, but it means that there is gold or silver, you know, mixed in with the you know, the making of the basket. Okay. So this excludes then the chfifa mitzvahs loichazia. This would show us then that the kafifa mitzvahs, where we said before that she has to bring her sacrifice, the sota has to bring her sacrifice in a basket made of twigs, which is the way we understand it. Remember, we had the Rashi on the top of the page where he understands that mitzvahs doesn't mean Egyptian, but it means instead made out of nitzorim. In other words, a netzer is like twigs. It was made from the bottom part of the palm tree, where it's kind of rough and so on, but you could take it, you see, and use it in order to weave baskets with it. Okay. So it would show then that lochazia, that's not a worthy thing. Come on. So this is in accordance with whose opinion that, you know, just an ordinary wicker basket is not really the kind of thing that you would bring a sacrifice to the Beis HaMikdash. It says, Doloka Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda. This cannot be in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Yossi, the son of Rabbi Yehuda. Why? The Tanya, because we have learned, Kli Shoreis Shahason Shel Eitz, if we have a ministering vessel, in other words, something that you use in order to bring sacrifices to the Beis HaMikdash, and it's made out of wood. So Rabbi Posel, Rabbi Yehuda Anossi says that it's not valid. Okay? For Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda Machshir, right? But Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda, he says it's okay. So, how about in the case over here? So it says, Afilu Tema Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda. Even if you would say that, you know, you could substantiate, let's say, the opinion of Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda, but Amo, we would say that Amar Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Yehuda Bechashuvim says, if you bring it, let's say, in wood, it has to be out of solid mahogany or something like that. In other words, an expensive wood, right? But the Chusin, Miyoma? But you mean to say that ordinary, a basket just made out of twigs from date palms and so on and so forth, which is, you know, you can get it anywhere in the marketplace or something like that. Would you say that this is the right thing to do it? So, it says, even Rabbi Yehuda, even Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda would agree that, you know, this is not the right thing to bring an ordinary mincha with, understand? In other words, when the sota brings it, that's because she has to abase herself, so to speak, by bringing it in something, you know, so ordinary as this. But if you would bring, or, you know, the ingredients for a mincha in a wooden basket, then it has to be something which is choshev. It has to be something which is considered important.
But I thought
yes.
Sometimes mincha offerings were brought at the very poorest of the offerings. People who couldn't afford animals or birds, they would bring a simple mincha offering. Now,
yeah, that's correct.
Poor people
right.
Wouldn't be able to afford fancy baskets either.
Right, right. But maybe you could get a better quality or you could get a poorer quality. You understand? I have to assume that would be. I mean, you raise a very valid point. But while he says that, you know, wood would be permissible, but it should be, you know, something which is substantial and not something so insubstantial as that. Because why? Lastly, the Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda, Akrivehu, Dodef Lachsecha, Doesn't Rabbi Yosef Bar Yehuda also agree with the sentiment of the prophet? We have in the last chapter of Malachi, you know, Malachi was the last of the prophets, and there, it's a very short book, but one of the things he criticizes is the fact that people are only going through the motions of religion. And particularly when it comes to the, you know, bringing sacrifices to the Beis HaMikdash. He says that people are simply going into their flock, and what do they take? They take animals that, you know, the ordinary animals that they would be ready, they're on their last legs or something like that, and that they're bringing them, you know, as a sacrifice, right? And then he has the phrase which says, if you would bring such an animal as a gift to the governor, would he be happy with it? Or would he literally raise your countenance, in other words, show favor unto you? And yet, to an ordinary person of importance, you know that when you give a gift, it has to be something that, you know, which is choshev, as we would say, right?
Worthy,
be important, worthy, and so on and so forth. And you don't simply take any old shmata, something that you're ready to throw out, and give it as a gift, because that person is going to be insulted. So, of course, what the prophet is saying is, so how could you have the chutzpah to do the same thing, of course, coming to the Beis HaMikdash and simply taking your cast-offs, right, and giving them. So this is Hakriveh Noda Techosecha. So by the same token, in other words, even Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Yehuda would also agree that, okay, I say that a wooden basket is okay, but it has to be something, you know, that's worthy in order to bring a mincha, not something, you know, just out of the 5 and 10 or something like that. 5 and 10, Olam Shalom. Ah, who remembers Woolworth in Days of Glory? Okay. All right. Then it says, V'nosan l'chlishoris m'kach b'lichoris. Well, it says, and then he puts it into a klishoris, and he sanctifies it in klishoris. So Shmat Minor says the Gemara. So from this we learn then that klishoris ain't m'kach in elimidas. We would say that the vessel in which you sanctify it, it has to be that you want it to be sacrificed, that you want it to be sanctified. In other words, it isn't enough to simply put it into something and say that automatically it becomes sanctified, but you have to desire that it becomes sanctified through it. In other words, it's similar to the idea of kavanah. And of course, I don't have to tell you that we learned a long time ago when we were studying the Gemara Brachos, you know, about the whole idea about kavanah. It plays a very important part over there. And we learned that in reality there is a difference of opinion as to whether kavanah is necessary or it's not necessary. Why? Ideally, kavanah is necessary. There's no question about it. I mean, when you say your prayers, it should be because you really want to pour out your heart to the Rebbeinu Shel Olam and you want to fulfill a mitzvah. Whatever mitzvah you want to do, again, it should have kavanah. This is why we say mitzvahs tzricha is kavanah, that mitzvahs require kavanah, right? This is the opinion of those who hold that it requires kavanah, okay? But there is a contrary opinion that says mitzvahs einan tzrichas kavanah, that the very fact that you're doing something which is good in itself, even if you didn't think about the fact that you're doing it for the purpose of doing something good, but still it's a good thing by itself. It's the difference, I mean, between whether you daven, for example, with kavanah, or you daven without kavanah. Now, we would say that davening without kavanah is inferior to davening with kavanah.
But it's better than not davening.
But it's better than not davening, exactly.
Doesn't that permeate Judaism?
Yes.
It's a whole, though, to give you credit for what you do,
right,
and not down you for what you don't do.
Right. Right.
And a mitzvah begets a mitzvah.
Well,
a mitzvah begets a mitzvah.
Yes.
Dying
yes.
Man,
right.
If he hadn't been religious or had the attitude or anything of that nature, he's accepted if he truly, is this correct? And his dying bed, if he truly approached the God, at that point, he's never been religious, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, but well, we say, ain't over him if they had tshuva, that there's nothing that stands in the way of tshuva. If a person actually, you know, wants to return to God and do that which is right, even if it's in dying moments. So also, I mean,
that's why you do tshuva every day.
Right. Well, of course, that's exactly it. I mean, it's... exactly.
Yeah,
this is what Rabbi Eliezer Ben Hurkan said. He said, you know, v'shuv yom echad ofnei b'sosach, he said, return unto God one day before you die. So who knows when we're going to die? So therefore, it means every day you should do tshuva.
That's right.
Okay, right.
Exactly. I know in modern times maybe it's incorrect, but there's like a person goes to shul.
Right.
He drives the shul for bottom.
Right.
The act of going up the steps and going to shul, you divide and say, okay, we give him credit. He came to shul.
You're right. Well,
no, okay. I agree with everything that you say,
right.
But I think that the rabbi's approach today would have to be in modern times.
Yeah, right.
He's never going to tell a person that he can drive.
Right.
Never.
The rabbi said just a few days ago, you know, that he can't accept the idea of all or nothing. That's not right. That something is better than nothing.
But if you can do more, better.
Right, there's no question about it. What we should strive to do is always to do the best that we possibly can. That is no question.
My mother always used to say that nobody's perfect, even the angels aren't perfect.
This is true. We say that in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur in our prayers, right. Actually, it's based upon a verb, a verse in the book of Job, where it says that you know, the Bnei Shalom finds fault even in the angels.
Was this vessel also burnt that the mint offering was given in? You say it was fancy wooden vessel?
That's a question. This is not what they're going to ask the question as to whether the kli itself was burnt on the altar or not. Obviously, it wouldn't make sense.
The one that the sotah brings.
Wouldn't make any difference, any kli, because after all, her was also was put eventually into a kli shavus, okay? But it's brought near the altar, okay? But the question is that when you pour the kometz, okay, do you take the kli and put it into the fire with the kometz? That wouldn't make much sense.
Wouldn't.
No. So instead, you have to pour it in, but of course, you have to be sure that everything, you know, goes into it. If you have something made of metal, at least there's a good chance that everything is going to get in. But that has to be there. With a wicker basket, you're going to have problems. All right. Okay. So, yeah. Right. Okay. That's all right. And then he has to put upon it the. Right, it says that he puts it into a ministering vessel and he sanctifies it. So this is what we just finished talking about,
right.
That you know, from this we would gather then that klishoris and mekachin elamidas, right, that you have to have the kabbona that you want to sanctify.